Live from Studio 550, it's the Martin Kilcoin Show. Here's Martin Kilcoin on KTRS.
Martin's off on vacation. I'm Paul Harris, proud to be in the chair with the headphones on and the microphone ready to roll for another couple of hours here. And then tomorrow I'll be on my regular Friday 3 to 6 show, filling in for Frank as I do every week. That show includes the Harris Challenge and Knuckleheads in the News. This show today will, about an hour from now, include a guy from Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America who has something to say about the Congress of the United States of America, in particular the Senate of the United States of America, which yesterday failed to pass a bill that would help our veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan get jobs. The unemployment rate for returning veterans is 2 to 3 times that of the rest of the country. Absolutely shameful. And yesterday they refused to allocate money for a Veterans Job Corps bill. It didn't have enough votes to get past a filibuster threat. But we'll talk to Tom Tarantino from IAVA, the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, about that a little bit later on. Let's see what else we have coming up on today's show. You may have heard a rumor, particularly if you're on Twitter, about a West Wing movie. Show ran for 8 seasons on NBC, one of the highest rated and most Emmy nominated and Emmy rewarded shows of the last couple of decades. And people have been saying, are they going to do a reunion? Are they going to do that sort of thing? Not quite. And it's not really a movie, but I have the full information on it. And I'll tell you about that a little bit later on, which leads right into this hour's guest. Ken Davis is a guy who wrote a book called Don't Know Much About History, which only sold, a million copies, spent something like 8-9 months on the bestseller list. And now he is out with a new one just in time for our election, 46 days away. It's called Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. And I thought we have plenty of stuff to talk about here, and so I've invited Ken to join me, and here he is. Hi, Ken. How are you?
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me back. And certainly is a perfect lead-in, the West Wing. I mean, that's the president we all loved. He could do no wrong, right?
Well, there were plenty of people who watched that show and thought, oh, that lousy liberal. But, you know, a lot of other people said, let's see what that lousy liberal is doing this week. And the show got a 30 share. So.
Yeah, you know, but more to the point, I think, Paul, is the story you were leading in with about the veterans. It's interesting, first of all, this year is the first time in anyone's memory that none of the four major candidates for president has military experience.
Yep.
Kind of interesting. I don't believe that had anything to do with the vote in the Senate yesterday, but it's just an interesting fact that used to be kind of considered you had to have some military experience to be a great president, which actually is a myth.
Well, once we got past the Vietnam generation and certainly the draft generation into an all-volunteer army, it became much more likely that we're going to get to this point, and now we have.
That's for sure. What's interesting is many people talk about great presidents and whether they were great generals or whether great generals make presidents, and hasn't always been the case. And in fact, the two greatest wartime presidents, Abraham Lincoln and Franklin D. Roosevelt, had no military service, although Roosevelt had been an undersecretary of the Navy. An interesting take on part of the presidential history that I talk about in the new book.
Now, when we talk about presidents and war, there have been many times in our history where a president has led our country into war or became president while our country was at war. And then when it came for time for reelection, people said, well, you don't gotta vote a guy out while he's in there. Lyndon Johnson would be the obvious guy who's the exception of that because he chose not to run because of Vietnam and other issues, but a great deal of that can be credited to the Vietnam War, which he escalated on his watch, and then he decided he didn't even want to be the candidate up for re-election in 1968. What's the history of other presidents and wars?
Oh, that's a good question, because that is one of the kind of myths that a sitting president during a war doesn't get always gets reelected. It goes back to 1812, 200 years ago. We're celebrating that anniversary. James Madison was reelected right in the midst of the war having just been declared. And so it sort of became a truism from there on. Lincoln, of course, famously said in the midst of the Civil War in 1864, they were getting ready to get rid of him as the Republican candidate, and he told his Republican brethren, it is wise not to swap horses in the middle of the stream. And, of course, he got the nomination and then went on to win, largely because there were some significant victories in the Civil War. But there's another one in there that's a little bit more obscure that I like to throw out, because the war is obscure and so is the president. Martin Van Buren, a one-term president, he had been in Andrew Jackson's cabinet. He lost a re-election bid during the very bad economy, but there was a war going on. It's a war that most Americans don't even know about, called the Seminole War. Fought, one of the longest wars in American history, fought against the Seminole Nation, mostly in Florida, and it dragged on for years. But Van Buren was the president while that was going on. He lost. Harry Truman also decided not to run during the Korean War. He was very, very unpopular. It's a good chance he wouldn't have been reelected during wartime. So that's one of those myths. And I guess the question is, do people think of this as wartime now? And does that carry over for Barack Obama? I tend to think that the Afghanistan situation has very little to do with how people are going to vote this year.
Well, I think most people don't even think about the fact that we're at war, as opposed to previous generations when we were in lengthy wars, meaning specifically Vietnam, but even back to World War II, when the media was talking about it every single day. In World War II, you had Edward R. Murrow reporting from London for CBS News from the rooftops, talking about the bombs dropping there, and that was a vivid recollection that we were at war. And during Vietnam, of course, you could watch the evening newscasts, and Huntley and Brinkley or Cronkite would show you film of the embedded reporters who were there covering that war and it all in all of its grisly detail. We don't see that anymore, even though we have even more news available to us. The war has become almost an unspoken thing, so I don't think it's even going to play a small role in people's decisions about the election.
Right, and it's probably a good question for another day. Why is that the case? Certainly we have young men and women in harm's way in uniform, and we are not paying a great deal of attention to them or to the it almost seems like it's an inconvenience, and we just wish it would be over with, and we're going to get out sooner or later. But you're absolutely right. Certainly, during World War II, you had the maps of the troops every day, the battle scenes on the front pages. Vietnam is the period I grew up in, and you're right. We saw the war every single night on the news. It was, and certainly there's no reason it shouldn't be, but. That's a decision that obviously has been made in the higher levels of the media world, because unless there's a disaster or something extraordinary, we hear very little about what's going on in Afghanistan.
It's the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris talking with Ken Davis about his book, which has just been published this week, called Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. Here we are talking about an election that's less than 7 weeks away and probably has more money pumped into it and many people would say more vitriol thrown from one candidate's camp at the other than any in history. But I bet you know otherwise, don't you?
I absolutely know otherwise. The money part, it's certainly true in terms of the massive number of dollars going into the campaign, but there's always been money in political campaigns. It's only since the 1970s and the Watergate era corruption that we got the beginning of campaign finance rules. But going back for a long time, money had always been handed out and generously. On the other point, the idea that this is the most vitriolic is really nonsense, and that's something that we can look back and say from 1796 on, the first real contested election between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, the knives came out right away. They were sharp, and they were not afraid to use them. This was not gentlemen in powdered wigs and frock coats. These were hard-hitting politicians who were not afraid to sling mud and get pretty nasty. John Adams was called an overweight monarchist, and that was kind of the polite stuff. Thomas Jefferson was accused, of course, of having a slave as a mistress, as a campaign charge, remember, back then. He was also accused of being a coward during the Revolution because he was governor of Virginia and actually had left his home to escape the British from attacking. So that was the kind of swift voting of its day. Andrew Jackson, a few years later, was accused of killing men. There was a handbill called the Coffin Handbill, plastered all over the country. It showed the number of coffins that Andrew Jackson was responsible for. So it's always been a nasty business, electing a president. It just gets magnified today because of the preeminence of television advertising and the internet, and now the Twitter is 24 hours.
Yeah, it seems amazing because we live in such an instant information age. You're talking about, okay, somebody had to print up a handbill, hand it out to somebody, go take these and nail them to some trees and some buildings all around, and that will be our attack ad. And then, you know, the other people didn't exactly have opposition research going on where they could quickly respond to that. Get our handbills printed up and get them out there. Or did they?
They just made stuff up. They didn't have to have opposition research. There was a famous pamphlet, for instance, Henry Clay, perhaps the most famous and greatest American politician who never became president. There was a pamphlet printed about him called 21 Reasons Why Henry Clay Should Not Be President. Number two was he spends his nights at the gaming tables and his days in the brothel.
Really?
That's the level that it was we're talking about men who were, you know, the greatest gentlemen politicians of their day, but it was not a nice business.
I can see the campaign slogan now. Henry Clay, craps by night, hookers by day.
That's basically what it came down to. Andrew Jackson, again, was accused of being an adulterer and a bigamist because there was some truth in that, actually. He had married his wife, Rachel, before she was legally divorced. So, in fact, they were adulterous and in a sort of a bigamist situation. She later got final approval for the divorce. But this was really used against him, and he would actually challenge men to duels, and did challenge men to duels over this insult to himself and, more important, to his wife.
You know, you mentioned before that none of the four candidates for president or vice president has served in the military. I think this is also the first time that none of those four candidates is a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant.
That's also correct, and I talk about that a great deal in this book, and I have talked about it, because we do have this, the kind of myth or misconception of the Christian nation. The nation was not Christian in the early years. It was a Protestant nation, and the anger and hatred towards Catholics in particular in the early part of this, of the 19th century and even and going way back to the beginnings of the country, was very, very pronounced. And of course it continued right up until 1960 when John F. Kennedy became the first Roman Catholic elected. In 1856, John Fremont was the Republican candidate, the first Republican candidate, and he was accused of being, first of all, he was accused of being a Canadian. It was the first birther controversy.
Oh, no!
Yes, it went back to 1856, and then he was accused of, even worse, being a Catholic in those days. Al Smith, the governor of New York, was caught up in a very, very ugly campaign in which he was accused of being in favor of rum and Romanism, the rum part being that he was in favor of ending Prohibition, Romanism being that he was a Catholic, and it was a very nasty thing. But even in 1960, people like Billy Graham and Norman Vincent Peale campaigned very hard against John F. Kennedy simply on the basis of his religion. So it has been an issue in the past. It's interesting in a way. Two of the most controversial religions in American history, Mormonism and Catholicism, that's what we have on the Republican ticket, and it seems to be not a big issue this year, which I'm actually happy to see.
You know, I'm shocked. I'm honestly going to say that I'm shocked that Mitt Romney's Mormonism has not become an issue. I think perhaps the reason for that is because there's no way Obama's people, even his fringest supporters, can start talking about that without seeming like they're talking about it in the ugliest possible terms, as you were just describing from the Kennedy years.
Well, I think you're very right, and we certainly saw a hint of it, a whiff of it emerge during the primary campaign when some of, I believe it was Governor Perry's supporters in Texas, talked about Mormons not being Christians and it was a cult. There's a really deep and long history of suspicion and hatred towards Mormons in this country. It's not a pretty part of our so-called melting pot story. In Missouri in the 19th century, the governor of Missouri actually ordered all the Mormons out of the state and said if they didn't get out by a certain time, they'd be exterminated. It was actually called the extermination letter. There were wars fought simply over religion. The founder of Mormonism was murdered by a mob while he was held in jail. So this is a very, very long and sad and tragic and often violent history. And but I think you're right. I don't think that any questions of Mormonism are going to come from the Democratic side. But I would be surprised if it goes all the way to the election without the issue being raised a little bit more.
Well, I think even if you don't see it happen overtly, I mean, what you just described from our past was about as overt as it could get when you're,
sure. You
know, the governor is saying, get out or I'll kill you. I think that one of the open questions of this election is going to be, will evangelical Christians vote for a Mormon?
Well, that's what I was hinting at when I mentioned that one of Governor's supporters, Governor Perry's supporters, who was an evangelical Christian minister,
yeah. Was
the one who came out quite vociferously against Romney, and I think the Republican Party in general kind of circled the wagons around him and said we weren't going to let that become an issue that would affect our nominee. So, but will it play out in the mainstream election in the general election? I don't know. I think it's an interesting question, and it's one of the things we'll have to be looking for on election night. Where are those evangelical Christians getting over their longtime antipathy towards Mormons to support somebody who seems to be at least politically and socially minded, culturally, more in line with their views?
This is the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris talking with Ken Davis about his book, Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. And I would say there are only 320 million people in America who should read your book because we don't know much about our presidents. And we also don't even know much about the founding of our country. You just talked about the question of the Christian nation and all that stuff. And you know, people always are arguing about this is what the founders intended. Ironically, yesterday was the 225th anniversary of the adoption of the U.S. Constitution, at the time, a unique document, and to this day, one that has been much copied. But before that, there was no such thing as a president, right?
Well, no, not exactly. There was a president. In fact, there were 14 presidents, depending on how you count them. But they were the presidents of the Congress of the United States. And they, as I said, there were 14 of them. They wielded nothing more threatening than a gavel for the most part. They really were the parliamentary person in charge of the order of business at Congress. They couldn't even answer a letter without Congress's permission. And by the way, in those days, the Congress was 13 states, each one with a vote. It wasn't each legislator getting a vote.
So that's the role.
That's one of the reasons the Articles of Confederation, the old Constitution, was a failure. And so in 1787, exactly what you just said, it was on September 17th, 1787, 225 years ago, that the Constitution was signed by the 39 framers who signed it, and with it, the presidency was created. And this was the subject they probably fought about more than any other in those long, more than 3 months of secret debates and deliberations in Philadelphia in 1787.
When you talk about the President of Congress, that was the role that John Hancock had when they signed the Declaration, right?
That's correct. He was the President of the United States Congress, and that would have been the first time that the words United States were used in a formal way. So some people have said, well, John Hancock was the first president. The man who was President of the Congress when the Articles of Confederation were adopted is a man named John Hanson. So some people say, well, he's actually the real first president. But again, when we're talking about the president as the executive leader of the branch of government, of the executive branch, that begins with George Washington, of course, and his election. These other men were really a piece of the legislature. They were not separated from the legislature. They had very little power. They certainly couldn't command an army. They couldn't negotiate a treaty. And that's why it's a kind of interesting trivia question, but it's not really presidential history.
You know, there's debate now about the men who run for the vice presidency being, you know, on the same ticket, Romney and Ryan, Obama and Biden. The first vice president of this country was John Adams, who, you correct me if I'm wrong here, got the job because he came in second to Washington, right?
That's correct, because that's the way the framers originally established the terms of election. They did not foresee, this was one of the great mistakes they made, they did not see the coming of the political parties. In fact, they disliked parties, which they called factions. George Washington warned against it. Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, all warned against the danger of party, which they thought were going to be more either religious parties or regional parties. They didn't see it quite the way that political parties emerged. And so in those days, under the first Constitution, the electors voted, and the man with the most votes became president, and the second-place senator, or first loser, became vice president. And that worked out fine under Washington and Adams, although Adams really did nothing for the eight years he was vice president. He was not part of Washington's inner circle. It became a problem in 1796 because Adams and Jefferson were now the leaders of very different parties, very different philosophies, but Adams finished first and Jefferson finished second, so Jefferson, of a different party, became vice president. They were actually pretty cordial for a while. It got worse, and then in 1800, they ran against each other again, and by then the gloves had really come off.
Can you imagine what the last few years would have been like if John McCain had been vice president of the United States, or the previous 8 years if George W. Bush had been president with Al Gore as his vice president?
It's an interesting question. Of course, that's why they amended the Constitution in 1804 to change the process by which the candidates would be chosen and the electors would cast their ballots, so that it really did become more of the ticket system as we understand it. 1800 was really interesting also because Thomas Jefferson and his kind of running mate, they didn't really think of them as a presidential candidate and the vice presidential candidate there, but his vice presidential candidate was Aaron Burr. But because of quirks in the system, those two finish in a tie for the presidency, and John Adams, the sitting president, finishes third. So Jefferson and Burr then go to the House of Representatives, where the situation is going to be settled under the Constitution. And it took 36 votes. It was a long time. It went right down to the wire. And it's called the Revolution of 1800. There was a lot of political skullduggery. There was a lot of political horse trading. But eventually, Thomas Jefferson is elected president. Aaron Burr becomes his vice president. And Jefferson was not happy with Burr because he thought that he was trying to win his way into the presidency before his time, and so they were not a happy president and vice president together.
You know, I was going to say, when we were talking about Bush and Gore or Obama and McCain, if that had happened, maybe there would be less sniping between the parties. But here you are telling me, when we had a winner and a runner-up as president and vice president, there was more sniping.
There was always sniping. It goes back around that same time. It's another interesting little piece of this whole story. Alexander Hamilton and John Adams were both what we would call Federalists of the same party, but Hamilton did not like Adams, so he wrote a pamphlet denouncing President Adams, even though he was in his own party. It's, you know, like some Republican coming out today with a pamphlet that really seriously would attack Mitt Romney. Oh, it's not unheard of, but back then it was pretty unusual, and it was devastating to John Adams. So it's always been a rough and tumble game, as we said earlier. It hasn't been neat and tidy, but somehow we've managed to survive more than 200 years of it.
All right, last question I have for you, Ken. When are we getting rid of the Electoral College?
Well, I'm a big proponent of getting rid of it myself. I believe that even if you are generous in terms of allowing that they had some good reasons for doing it back then, number one being the fact that people in one part of the country couldn't really get to know people in the other part of the country. There were difficulties of time and distance and communication. What they really wanted to do with the electors was keep the election from being in the hands of the general population. They thought that the people are easily misled, as one of the framers of the Constitution said. Maybe it's still true, I don't know, but that's why they didn't want this to be a popular choice, but they didn't want the legislature to do it either, because then the president would be beholden to the legislature. So they came up with this compromise of letting the states allow certain men, and they were men then, to be chosen as electors, and these electors would make the decision with the safety valve that if the electors didn't come up with a decision, that it would go to the House of Representatives. And as I mentioned, that happened right away in 1800, and it happened again in 1824. So it was a wonderful system devised by genius, but it had a lot of creaks and cranks and missteps in it, and that's why we've amended the Constitution 27 times.
Yeah.
The Electoral College, I think we're stuck with it because it's really in the interests of the two main parties to keep it. There is an interesting alternative that's going around the country right now, which is called the National Popular Vote legislation, and it basically means if all the states sign on to this idea, it would mean that the national popular winner would get the state's votes, rather than this thing where you win a state's electoral votes just by winning by one vote. So a state like Florida, for instance, in 2000 can tip the election. So that's a piece of legislation that's making its way around. It's very slow. Otherwise, we'd have to amend the Constitution to get rid of the Electoral College, a word that's not actually in the Constitution.
It would certainly change the concept of swing states as we now know them.
That's right. You know, it's part of the idea was to keep small states with very little population from being overwhelmed by the larger states. But what it's meant is that those smaller states have an undue or outsized representation. And because, you know, for instance, a person who casts a vote in Wyoming actually has more say in the presidential vote than a person who casts a vote in California, because the numbers of people are so much larger in California that those electors are spread out over a much larger number of people. So the system, I believe, is inherently unfair. It's archaic. It's undemocratic. And I think it's time for it to move on.
I agree 100%. And it's been a pleasure talking with you, Ken. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks a lot. We'll certainly be happy to talk again as we go forward in the next few weeks. It should be interesting.
The book is called Don't Know Much About the American Presidents, out just this week from Hyperion Books. Ken Davis, thanks for joining me today here on the Big 550 KTRS.